Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. Well, thank you very much for your continued support, and I would say thank you for your recent emails, but for a few days, we've had some communication problems. The contact form on the front page of the website hasn't been working. We're working on that right now. My webmaster, Adam Cornwell, at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, is doing hard work trying to find out where the bug and problem is. So by the time that you hear this, the chances are that's going to be fixed and you will be able to email me. But I'm really sorry if you've tried to email the show and maybe you wanted to get in touch about the last edition, about 9/11, and you weren't able to, or make a guest suggestion or a comment about the show. Really sorry about that, but hopefully we're back up and running. Another reason for re-recording this intro to this edition of The Unexplained is very simply that the situation in Syria that I commented about seems to be changing. Public opinion seems to be having a bit of an impact. And also, the Russians seem to have played a very good hand and seem to be taking the upper hand in all of this now. Of course, anything could happen. But I think one thing that we have proved here is that President Barack Obama may well have been wrong about this, as was the Prime Minister of the UK, David Cameron. And, of course, Mr. Cameron was effectively voted down by the British Parliament, so we are not going to get involved in any kind of action against Syria. But it's also now looking, despite President Obama's speech to the nation, which I heard go out live in the middle of the night UK time a few days ago, it just seems like America is not going to go steaming into this one. And I will say here now something I said on the original intro to this show, and I think it still stands, that history proves that it's not a good idea to go in and mess with this region, because once you go in, you have to stay in. In any form, once you get involved, you stay involved. And that's not just me voicing an opinion here. That's really the lesson from history. We know that. We've seen that happen in the past, that if you get stuck into a conflict of any kind in that region, be it Iraq, Afghanistan, be it Libya, whatever it may be, you're in for the long haul. And even if you're told by politicians that you're not, I'm afraid on this occasion, I just don't believe them. But that's only a personal view, and a lot of you have been asking me to express my views, so there you go. David Paulides, we've been trying to get hold of him for about a year or more now. You very much want to get this man on, and I'm very pleased to say that David has been in contact. I have a copy of his latest book, which I'm really, really enjoying. So David Paulides coming soon on Disappeared People here at The Unexplained. What a book this man has written, so we'll get into that on a future edition, probably the next one, but we'll see. This time round, I'm going to talk to a man called Wilbur Allen in the US. This guy's got an amazing story. As he pointed out to me, the story started here in the UK. He's an American guy, the son of a military man, who says that he's been abducted by aliens who've had an impact on him through his whole life. But his great claim to fame is the fact that he's produced some of the sharpest and best resolution photographs of UFOs that I've ever seen on his website. And for that reason, and for the hard work that he's done in this field, I think he's worth hearing here. So his name is Wilbur Allen, and we'll get to him in just a second. Just to say, if you want to send me a comment about the show, make a guest suggestion, or indeed a donation, donation's vital to this show. We are a very, very bare-bones little outfit here. There's only me and Adam and you, three people involved in this. And literally any contribution that you could possibly make would be fantastic. Unfortunately, I'm not a corporation. I don't have bottomless pits of cash. So if it's possible to make a donation, great. If you can't, of course, as I've always said, just enjoy the show. Crank up the volume. All right, let's get to Wilbur Allen now in the United States. And say, Wilbur Allen, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, listen, I've got to say that I'm recording this at, 9 o'clock in the UK. People are going to work. It is a working day here and autumn is on the way, but you're 5 hours behind me in Washington, D.C., and you're still awake. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. How come you keep these late nights?
I scan the skies nightly, especially after leading an expedition into Area 51 for country music television. And I encountered something in the desert there. And ironically, that anomaly that I photographed in Groom Lake, Area 51, is now imaged over my home nightly.
Right. So whatever it is that you saw, and I want to talk about Area 51 a little later, but whatever it is you saw there came home with you.
It came home with me, exactly.
And that, I don't want to spoil the story that we're about to get into, but that's been a bit of a theme of your life. Like a lot of people back in the Cold War era, from the United States and from this country, they found themselves as families displaced because of the military thing. You were a military kid, and you lived your childhood here in the UK. And that,
yes, I did.
According to an email that you sent me when we were setting all this up, that's how it all started. Tell me that story.
My father was stationed at a RAF, USAF base called Sculthorpe. And one night as a child, we lived in a farmhouse in Sheringham. And I awoke to the door to my room bursting open, and in walked five small childlike alien grays in silver spacesuits. And they approached me face to face and my brother, who wouldn't wake up, and they implanted me at that point.
Now, as an adult, if that happened to me here in London, I would be pretty frightened. As a child in Sheringham, which is, you know, apart from military activity there over the years, pretty quiet place. It's Norfolk. It's east of England. It's one of the quietest parts of the UK. If I was a child and that happened to me in my bedroom, I would be apoplectic with fear.
And that was indeed the case. Nightly after that event, my father would essentially have to beat me to go to bed because I refused to go back into my room. And no matter where we lived and no matter what base it was and no matter what the country, it would always happen again. And it continued to happen up until about my high school years.
And that first contact, what was it like? What did they tell you?
They didn't tell me anything. What was surprising is I could hear their thoughts as they entered the room, and they were surprised to see me awake, as I was surprised to see them coming into my room. And at that point, when I tried to scream and run, I noticed my legs didn't work and my vocal cords were no longer functional. And what they apparently did was applied a dampening field to the cerebral cortex of the brain, which stops the flow of information to the body. And that's how they essentially get people to come on board their spacecraft and examine them when they do visit them.
Well, they neutralize you effectively. But as a kid, you couldn't have known that they'd put a dampening cord on your cerebral cortex.
I did not know that until after it kept happening. Mm. And, you know, obviously, as I grew older, it became more scientific. And unlike most people who have had these encounters who become psychologically and emotionally unstable, I seem to be learning from this and basically gathering information from all of the anomalies that land in front of me.
So there you are. You're a child. Tell me again how old you were.
Five.
Five. Okay, so you're old enough to understand things, but you're definitely not old enough to understand everything. And there you find yourself in a situation where you're encountering beings. Now, there will be people who say that, you know, back in that era, there were a lot of kids sci-fi space style series on television in the UK. I mean, we had Doctor Who, the very famous Doctor Who that's still running now. And there were Thunderbirds and all sorts of other stuff. And they would accuse you of an overactive imagination, I guess.
They did indeed accuse me of that. But what's interesting is in 1950, there was a crash in New Mexico with three disc objects, which were taken down by a radar field. And back in those days, they were using high voltage radar. And that the crash occupants were small gray aliens in silver spacesuits.
Exactly what you encountered.
Exactly. This is 1950, and what I encountered was 1962.
And we've got to say, at 5 years of age, it's unlikely that you'd have done a lot of high-level research about that. You were not expecting that, I wouldn't have thought.
My parents didn't really... I was not raised on television, and in England especially, there weren't very many children programs in the 60s, per se, other than those little cheesy puppet cartoons that they had.
We didn't have a whole lot of television then. I think we had two channels back in the 60s.
Right, it wasn't too advanced. You know, it wasn't like, you know, like some high-end George Lucas stuff. But, you know, that what I encountered was so devastating in a point that it essentially created a sense of post-traumatic stress in me. And it scared me to the point where, you know, I didn't function normally because I'd been scared silly after seeing these aliens. Now, what's interesting is that it seems that whatever these beings had as an agenda, that they wanted me to essentially develop to this, what I'm working into now with my website at ufodc.com. And that is that they allow me to document alien activity with my cameras.
And why do you think they picked you, aged five, living in Norfolk? Of all the people they could have picked a son or daughter of the president of the U.S. They could have picked anybody else, really. They could have picked me, but they picked you.
Well, it's interesting. If you're familiar with Betty and Barney Hill, yes. Betty and Barney Hill are an interracial couple, and my mother is German, French-German, and my father is African-American, and I'm the product of an interracial marriage.
And you believe, presumably, then, that that's their interest? They're interested in how races mix?
They looked at the hybrid aspect of it. And back in the 60s, when a black man made it with a white woman, you were definitely a hybrid.
Mm. Right. Yeah, attitudes very, very different, especially in this country, I think, back then, but around the world, really.
Oh, it's changed considerably. But for the time that it was in place, many people that listened to what I had to say, especially as an interracial child, talking about extraterrestrial visitations, it wasn't greeted well with most of the people that I spoke to in the schools that I went to on a military basis that I lived. And essentially what they did to eliminate me from talking the things that I was saying to the children, they placed me in special ed.
They put you in special education, so they gave you separate treatment.
Yes, they did. They separated me from normal people, yes.
Wow, that sounds to me like it could have laid up a whole mass of problems for you in your life.
It did for a moment, but and understanding though that in most situations when these occurrences did take place for me or to me actually, that I learned from them, and it is essentially evolved me to this point. I'm enriched by that. I'm not afraid of that anymore.
Sounds to me like, unlike a lot of people who report these things to others and are judged on that basis and suffer for it, it sounds to me like, as indeed you hinted, you've come out of it stronger.
Well, I came out of it in an interesting sense, especially with the fact that I became a White House Air Force One engineer, a contractor for ABC News. So I got into a position of power and in a place of power. And while working in the White House, a supervisor of mine had an encounter at the Capitol in which he claimed to have seen aliens around then Senator John Glenn. And a year after he claimed to have seen aliens, I had the close encounter in the lower Senate park of the U.S. Capitol building.
All right. Let's just very quickly go back to the childhood time and that first encounter when you were five, though. What did you come out of it believing had happened?
Well, I was implanted at that time. And for about 11 years after that, nightly I vomited. And when the vomiting stopped, and then military doctors at that in those days, they didn't have the advanced technology they have now. So what they implanted in me in 1962 is now fused into my central nervous system. And this implanted object is sending me signals and telling me when and where to take photographs. And if you look at my website and you look at all the material on my website, you notice all the samples are all close proximity or, in fact, landing directly in front of me.
Age five, though, Will, but I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes,
how did you
yes.
know that you had an implant? Who told you that?
The vomiting.
Right. Because of where it was. Was it in your neck somewhere that it was obstructing something?
It's inside behind my ear.
Okay.
Inside the head. It's inside the head.
And apart from you knowing that it was there, did any doctor find it, see it?
They couldn't figure out why. Especially after all the tests that I went through that I vomited nightly, they never figured out why that was happening, because in 1962, they didn't have the technology to detect if anything was implanted in people.
So did the aliens tell you that they'd implanted you? I'm just keen to know how you knew that you had an implant there.
By the fact that they constantly monitored me from every year after the encounter when I was a child.
You mean the aliens kept coming back?
Every year.
All right, and they presumably checked on your implant?
Yes.
And that's how you knew. Now, you said the first time round they didn't communicate with you. Presumably, they started communicating at some point. Okay.
Not verbally. None of it is ever verbal. And in fact, and I'll go back to Area 51. What I encountered in Area 51 communicated with me telepathically.
So that just became the norm over the years? Just became what happened?
Yes.
And when you told your dad about that, What did he say?
I believe my father knew. My father was military intelligence, and I'll explain a reason why I think he knew. And one point in our life, after we left England, my father was moved to a base in Denver, Colorado, called Laurie Air Force Base. And he got orders to deploy to Vietnam and was deployed to a base in California called Castle Air Force Base before going to Vietnam. But to get to Castle Air Force Base from Laurie, we had to drive through Nevada near Area 51. And as a child, I looked up in the sky and it was nighttime, and my father was going on the highway towards the base. And I noticed a white dot zigzagging in the sky. And when I told my father, "Hey, Dad, there's an object zigzagging in the sky." And I think I was 8 or 9 years old at that time. Instead of my father stopping, he stepped on the gas. I'd never seen my father drive that fast before, but he stepped on the gas to make sure he got out of the area as fast as possible.
So you think he knew what that was?
Without a doubt, without saying anything. I mean, as you could see from the actions of my parents, that he had some substantial concerns about my statement. And when I said I saw the white dot zigzagging above the car, he stepped on the gas, and that was the end of it.
What about your encounters when you got to those formative teenage years? Things must have changed surely then.
Things got really abstract. Things would happen that were outside of the norm. For example, I suffered, I was in an explosion in eighth grade, and I mixed a batch of acid in a flask, and essentially it was a 500 milliliter flask, and I mixed hydrochloric acid, sulfuric acid, nitric acid with iodine, and the flask exploded on me, and my body sustained substantial burns. 50% of my body had third degree burns. And if you look at me today, there's no scars.
So are we assuming that they fixed you?
They fixed me, exactly.
Do you remember that?
I held a thought, and in my mind, they wanted me to maintain a thought of how I should look, and I developed and healed in exact manner of my thoughts.
By this stage, this was all very much, as we said, the norm for you.
It was abstract in the sense that it wasn't necessarily something that one would say or consider as a normal motion in life, to be able to think things to happen and have them to happen.
So here you were, a most unusual young man, living your life, I guess, as best you can, getting your qualifications and moving forward. Professionally, when you finished school, how did you get yourself onto the path that took you to the White House?
I think that I got hired by ABC News as a contractor. And when they looked at my background, coming from a U.S. military family and my father being U.S. military intelligence, I think that they would see that just based on my background. And generally speaking, if you do get a job that requires some kind of security and security screening, that they look at your parents first before they look at the individual to see if that parent, that person came from, has a adequate background to be classified as worthy of a security clearance.
Yeah, I'm sure they still do that today. I guess they have to.
Yes, they do. They have to, because, you know, you can have a daughter or a son, and if you were in jail or in prison, your daughter and son will never get a high security government job at all, because they're considered a guilt through association.
Okay, so the job you ended up doing at the White House, for the White House, that I've got here in your biographical details is Air Force One engineer for ABC News. You better explain that. That sounds intriguing.
Well, usually they would put you in a situation where, and I have a 100% track record, so wherever I set up my jobs for ABC, they were always 100% correct. So when they looked at the level of professionalism associated to the job, and they saw that my track record was squeak clean in terms of setup, that the logical person to be around a person of power like the President of the United States would be someone who would have a perfectionist state of mind to do the job correctly. And I did proceed with my job with accuracy and never made a mistake.
And what exactly was the job?
Transmission engineering for wherever the president went, if he would go on location, on wherever locations would be, I would set up all of the audiovisual transmission systems for ABC to make sure that everything was live.
That's an incredibly responsible job.
Well, usually it's pre-set up. It's not like, you know, one person's going to go in there and do this entire job. Generally, what happens, the network sets up other people to set up the equipment, and all you're going to do is go in there and push the button. It's already technically set up for you, but right. It does require you have to have a level of expertise to make sure that it is done correctly.
And to be able to troubleshoot, presumably, if it all goes down.
Well, there's never a problem. That's one of the issues that they tried to address when they send people in there who are definitely qualified to do the job, and a person that's qualified to do the job makes sure it's done correctly, and it's always 100%, and that was my case.
Now, for a guy connected with aliens, and I should really have asked you what kind of aliens they were, I'm assuming that they're greys, as they call them.
Yes.
Being around the White House and around the president is exactly the right place to be.
Well, consider that Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev had a summit regarding these nuclear missiles that were set into launch mode in Russia by aliens, and they knew that it was a situation that was generated by a UFO that was stationed outside a nuclear silo in Russia. It was cause for concern, and the president of the United States at that time, Ronald Reagan, had the initiative to put the Star Wars Amendment together, which was a device that was supposed to orbit in the atmosphere of Earth and protect us from outside threats, not inside threats. But it got misinterpreted, and that program was scrapped.
Was this your era? Were you around then?
Yes.
That's when you were doing this job?
Yes.
And what sorts of things, because you've just indicated one of them, that very famous event where apparently nuclear missiles were messed with by something not from this Earth, hence the need for a meeting between the two heads of state. What sorts of stuff were you hearing about that?
They were concerned about how a silo full of trained professionals sitting at their posts, playing cards, talking, eating food, how a missile could go into full launch mode without being touched. And think about it. We're talking about 1982, 1983. I'm not completely accurate on the date, so don't quote me on that. But I'm safe to assume that the level of technology wasn't at the point where, you know, like today you can send a signal to something and it would automatically activate your alarm at your house or monitor your alarm system from your cell phone. That kind of technology didn't exist in 1982, and they were concerned about how a UFO could activate a missile. And it also happened, I believe, in an area in Nevada where there were missile silos and a whole sequence of missiles went into launch mode.
Of course, that goes against the theory that a lot of ufologists tend to have, that presidents for generations have been in contact with them upstairs. And if Reagan had known them so well, then, and Gorbachev had known them so well, then they'd have known what was going on and who was behind it, wouldn't they? They wouldn't have had to discuss it. They'd have known.
Oh, well, I think that's something we need to take up with Madeleine Eisenhower, because it was her father that made contact with aliens during the Roswell incident. So, you know, it is something that needs to be addressed. But indeed, at some point, there was contact with the president of the United States and the extraterrestrials when those events were taking place during Roswell and during the event in 1950.
Meantime, your contacts with aliens, with the Greys, were ongoing, presumably, through this period.
Well, I wasn't born in 1950.
The Reagan period.
Oh, yes, exactly. The Reagan period. It was, you know, I didn't really have the technology per se, but they were feeding me this technology where, for example, I started processing film in the microwave and noticing that the film that I processed in the microwave would reveal airborne objects in some of the samples, and that's one of the samples I'm talking about at the U.S. Capitol building where I documented the green objects.
When you say you were processing film in the microwave, I don't quite understand. What does that mean?
I had invented this technology, and it was unheard of at the time to process film in a microwave. And
to actually put the film, I studied photography, so I did all of that kind of darkroom developing and printing stuff. Great fun. Actually doing it in a microwave oven?
In a microwave oven, yes.
Right.
And some of the samples that I generated were absolutely extraordinary, especially nighttime imagery with film set at 12 ASA. And normally speaking, 12 ASA, you would need something like extreme bright sunlight to take a photograph. But at 12 ASA, I was taking high definition night, full color night vision imagery.
And what was the microwave? This is fascinating to me. I'm sorry if you're listening to this and you think I'm getting too technical about it. But
I'm more than willing to give you
a little note for my listeners, really. But it sounds complicated.
When you look at color film processing, for example, one of the things that was crucial in film processing, especially in color film, was maintaining the color temperature, because a slight shift in color temperature would mean your film would either go orange if it's too hot, or would go blue if it's too cold. So in dealing with chemistry at a molecular level, we're not heating the chemistry using a coil, which would generally move the heat because the metal is becoming hot. I started looking at heating the chemistry at the molecular level. And when molecules are rubbing, and generally speaking, when you microwave something, it heats up because the molecules are accelerated. Well, accelerating the molecules and processing the film also seem to have the same effect as, I'm not sure if you're familiar with polishing stones in the rock tumbler.
Oh, yes.
But it polishes the emulsion of the film. And when you look at the sample, especially with what I was doing, And I used the technology on an entertainment level also, because Miles Davis was my client and I used it on Miles Davis. Miles Davis hated to flash, so I had to use a technology that enabled me to take a picture of an extremely black person and take a photograph of him on the stage with stage lighting and be able to show the highlights of this person. And it did, using the technology that I was fed through the extraterrestrials. And that's what I used to generate most of the samples that I have right now that are film-based.
So they gave you the lead here. They taught you how to do this, and you started to use it for low-light level photography.
I never really studied photography, and as a child, I lived on a base in the Philippines during the Vietnam War, and some friends of mine and I, in junior high school, snuck into the CIA film lab, and they taught us the film technology used then, but it was nothing like what the aliens downloaded into me.
Wow. That's all I can say. That is just amazing. So suddenly you find yourself being able to not enhance, but improve the kind of images that we can take with an old-fashioned film camera by night, so that they suddenly become full HD nighttime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of those samples, if you go to my website, there's a National Geographic page there. If you click on the National Geographic page, my pictures come up. But what's interesting with the Nat Geo pages is they have a section on those pages which shows you the metadata, if it's appropriate to show the metadata, which metadata is generally digital information that's generated by the camera and imprinted on the image itself. But with the metadata and the information that's generated even using a film scanner, that information is transferred into the photograph, and you're able to see the technical specs of each image that I take on my National Geographic page as a reference file.
And you're absolutely sure, and this is maybe a dumb question from somebody who doesn't know as much about it as you do, but you're absolutely sure that the microwaves that you were using to process these films were not actually creating the images?
They were not byproduct of the microwave itself, because keeping in mind, the microwaves were not microwaving the film. The microwaves heated the chemistry, and it was different at that level. It was not necessarily the film in the microwave itself, because the film is contained in a film processor, in a processing drum, which is metal, which you know you can't microwave. But what I did to maintain the chemistry inside a processor, which I invented, which was essentially similar to a thermos. And you know the theory behind a thermos: you can put something hot in it, and it'll stay the same temperature for an extended period of time because there's no place for the heat to escape, and therefore it stays hot. Well, the processor that I invented had the same characteristics as a thermos. And when I applied microwaves to the chemistry, especially for color processing, it was more consistent and linear in developing the film itself.
So here you are, young guy working around the White House for ABC News. Responsible job, as we said. Connected to the right people, as we said, taking photographs of what goes on in the sky, meantime, and developing them in a unique way. What happens then?
Well, I go public with the information, and the minute I go public, and this is in 2002, you know, it's difficult, especially when you encounter something and there is no actual physical evidence to substantiate your samples, especially if your samples are so extraordinary people think they're fake.
And you said you went public with the information. Which information did you go public with?
That extraterrestrials had landed at the U.S. Capitol building July 16th in 2002.
Right. And what, I'll ask you what everybody else will have asked you then, what proof of that did you have?
Well, at that time, I had absolutely no proof at all, and other than the photographic evidence that I witnessed and photographed, and the other people that were with me that were there that witnessed the events as I was photographing them.
Now, you live in Washington, and you spend a lot of your time taking pictures of what happens over Washington.
Yes, I do.
So what happened there then, or what you say happened there then, would really have been no surprise to you?
Well, it was no surprise to me at all, especially after documenting an object landing on a roof of the Capitol. But what was interesting was the object that I photographed over Senate Park. And it was a series of four luminous green spheres. Well, in 1967, during the launch of Apollo 7, the crew of Apollo 7 noticed a luminous green object leaving Earth's atmosphere and flying out into outer space, and they photographed it. And I was able to retrieve a sample of that photograph and compare it to the objects that I photographed at the U.S. Capitol building and saw that they were a 100% match. Then during Apollo 11, during the launch of Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin noticed outside the command module a series of formation of luminous green objects which had fluidic characteristics following the command module. And they took 16-millimeter motion picture film of this luminous green object outside the command module. Well, I got a sample of that 16-millimeter footage, and the 16-millimeter footage comparative analysis compared to the footage from Apollo 7 and compared to the footage from the U.S. Capitol building July 16, 2002, that in the comparative analysis, all the samples were a 100% match. So that indicated that the samples that were imaged in space by Apollo 7 and Apollo 11 and the samples that I imaged at the U.S. Capitol building were indeed extraterrestrial in origin.
Now, you were having regular contact with aliens. They were allowing you to find out all of this stuff yourself by your own research.
Yes.
I'm curious why they didn't want to accelerate your development by telling you this rather than making you go and research it for yourself.
I think it all was all in the making. One of the things that I think that they had to work out of me was the fear factor. And when the visitation started, man, believe me when I tell you, I spent most of my time under the cover and under the bed trying to avoid looking at these things. And I knew they were there. And there was nothing I can do about it other than stay under the cover and not look. And it happened constantly and periodically throughout the development of my life into early adulthood. And now what's even more abstract is it's gone full-fledged and objects are now landing directly in front of me.
So they're very, very much focused upon you.
Yes.
Even after all these years.
Yes, they seek me out.
Have they told you now by this stage of your life what the end game of all of this is? What is it that they want you to have achieved by the end of your life?
Nothing, but I know that at one point or another, if I do expire, they can't say I didn't do a thing with my life. They won't be able to say that at all. But one of the things that's interesting is the amount of data that I'm able to accumulate and the accumulation of data using advanced technology. And one of the things I did for the study of extraterrestrial anomalies and UFOs is I looked at what NASA was using in space, and at a photographic level, that is. And on board the space station, NASA is using a D3S Nikon. Well, I'm using a D4, which is double the technology that D3S Nikon has. And the technology that I'm using right now at 100 ISO has been able to generate video, which without a doubt shows how extraterrestrial objects are able to enter into our airspace undetected and how they leave our airspace in the same manner in which they enter. And, it's
even
more.
And so you're saying that you're using photographic techniques that are so fast, NASA is not using them, that you can capture this stuff,
NASA can't. NASA is using this technology.
It's not telling us.
They're not telling us this. If I'm getting this with a D4, I'm quite sure they're getting it with a D3S. And, you know, one of the things that's even more compelling with all of the information that I'm able to generate is that the amount of physical evidence that's consistent. And we look at consistent evidence in terms of when you put everything together and you put them side by side and you say, okay, this object looks like this object, which looks like this object, which looks like this object. And when you get a whole chapter or 100 or 200 or 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 samples, which all look the same, you can basically conclude without a doubt that first the anomaly is real and that it is not a byproduct of the camera.
So are you saying from the, and I've seen some of the pictures that you produced, and they are very, very impressive at your website. I recommend anybody who wants to know more to go to it, and we'll give the website address at the end of this show. Are you saying that aliens are able to slip into our atmosphere, slip into our present, just like a button going through a buttonhole? They just kind of appear through a portal, and it happens that fast in not even the blink of an eye, and that's why we don't see them.
That's exactly why we don't see them, and that's why when, in some cases, where you look at reports generated by air traffic controllers, where they indicated while watching the radar screen how a blip would suddenly appear, and then fly through the radar screen and then vanish. Well, what I documented in Sedona was an object which it out of nowhere, and if you look at the frame-by-frame analysis of the video that was generated, it showed without a doubt that this object materialized and it flew through the frame as it was materializing at a constant velocity. What was even more abstract is the object came back 2 hours later, and as it came back 2 hours later, it was scanning treetops. It scanned my room with pure white light, and then it warped forward and vanished as it was moving forward in the same manner in which it materialized into the same airspace 2 hours earlier. So I indeed documented how they come and how they go.
I want to get back to the Washington landing because I don't want to lose that point.
Yes.
Why did they want to land at the White House? What were they doing?
They didn't land at the White House. They landed
the
at
Capitol,
the U.S.
Capitol. Sorry, the Capitol building. Let's get that right. Sorry.
And if you look at it, the White House is the power hub for the United States, for the president of the United States. But he has to go through Congress, which is the Capitol building, which has all of the senators and congressmen, which represent all the states. Now, when you think about it, where would you rather infiltrate, where everybody exists or where one person exists, which would be the president? I would infiltrate the building where everybody is. That way I know where everybody, what everybody is thinking.
And what do you know about that event? What have you been told about that event?
I'm only, as Stanton Friedman would say, reading into the sample. And based on what I photographed July 16th in 2002, it indicated without a doubt that there was an extraterrestrial visitation taking place, and that whatever this object was that I photographed over Lower Senate Park, something came out of it and landed on top of the roof of the U.S. Capitol building. Something came out of it and landed in the rear of the reflection pool, which is in front of the U.S. Capitol building. And the object that landed in the reflection pool area also entered into the water, and I imaged it as it was swimming. And what was interesting in the sample, as this object was swimming, I noticed that the reflection pool had thousands of microscopic green lights associated to it in the water. So basically, I'm assuming, and from what I gathered from the photograph that I took from Lower Senate Park of the luminous green objects that were parked above my head, they were discharging objects out of them by the thousands. They were dripping them into the air. The object that entered into the water was discharging objects out of it, and they were attaching themselves to the algae that was in the bottom of the reflection pool, which, by the way, a few years later, 25 ducks were found dead in the same part of the reflection pool that I imaged this anomaly.
Do you believe that's a portal then?
I believe that there is definitely a Stargate there in the area of the U.S. Capitol building, because from the photographic evidence that I generated from Lower Senate Park, the object that I photographed, as it parked above my head and it started to move, it moved forward. And as it moved forward, it dematerialized. It moved upwards, dematerialized, moved forwards, rematerialized, and started vibrating in multiple directions, X, Y, and Z. If you know, if we plant a three-dimensional graph and we have X, Y, and Z coordinates, and whatever this object was, and I'm using a film sample to photograph this thing, In the film sample, it shows a digital pattern in a three-dimensional sphere, which shows multiple repeating elements. And this object was vibrating in multiple directions, and then it vanishes. And then there's a flash of light, and in the flash of light, you see a hole open in the sky, and the object flew into the hole. What was interesting, and Dr. Mitchell looked at that material and explained without a doubt how these extraterrestrial anomalies are using wormhole technology to enter into our airspace. And my footage essentially confirms everything we discussed in our lecture. And I lectured with Dr. Mitchell at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey a few years ago. And it's basically confirmation to everything these astronauts are encountering in space, but are told not to talk about by NASA.
Well, I have to say that you know that I had Edgar Mitchell on this show. And we did an hour together.
I did not know that.
Well, we had an hour together on this show about 2 years ago, maybe. And I did ask him quite specifically about all of this, and he was very good on the generalities, but wouldn't go into an awful lot of detail. Do you believe that the NASA astronauts, the Apollo astronauts, have been made to keep reasonably quiet about what they know? They know far more than they're saying, in other words.
They're told to be absolutely quiet. Mm. And think about this. My association to the Apollo astronauts is in a small fraternity, because those astronauts that did indeed encounter this green anomaly, they encountered theirs in space. I encountered mine on Earth. So it put us in a fraternity. So we have individuals who have firsthand information and contact with these objects. They were Edgar Mitchell, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, and a few other astronauts along the way, the crew of Apollo 7. And, you know, when they did encounter these things, and one of the things that was interesting and based on the Brookings Institute report is that if they did indeed start talking about it, that there was a strong possibility that their dialogue could destabilize society. But look at how society is now destabilized anyway. And it's not because of extraterrestrials. So we look at how they're told not to say things, and they're covering their ass because they don't want to lose their pension, and you can lose your pension quickly here. I did 18 years in the White House, working in the White House. I have no pension because they gave me the pink slip after 18.5 years, and that was shortly after talking about my supervisor having an encounter with extraterrestrials at the U.S. Capitol building.
Which I want to talk about. What happened in that event? You talked about it at the time. I haven't heard about it, but that's just probably because I haven't seen it anywhere. So tell me what happened.
Well, nothing transpired from any of this. You know, I was interviewed by the U.S. Capitol Police, by the detective division.
That was after you'd said that your supervisor had had an encounter.
Well, no, after my supervisor had the encounter. I didn't have the encounter at the U.S. Capitol building until a year afterwards. And initially, when my friend flew over to Cuckoo's Nest, I thought that he was off his rocker. And, you know, when you start talking about aliens, John Glenn, here's an astronaut, and he was talking about seeing aliens around John Glenn in the Senate hearing, and it made him lose all sense of reality and consciousness, and he actually...
Well, the truth of it is, an awful lot of people, even now hearing this, will say that is just the most outlandish and wacko thing that you could possibly say.
Absolutely Looney Tune, but look at the facts. A year later, I have a close encounter at the U.S. Capitol building, and in the same essential area that he claimed to have seen aliens around John Glenn, and the photographic evidence indicates that is indeed the case. So I can't now say that my friend was loony. I have to say I have to agree with everything that he experienced while he saw what he saw that drove him to the point of insanity. There were aliens at the U.S. Capitol building.
And what about your close encounter? What happened to you?
After that, about a year after the encounter at the U.S. Capitol building, I awoke in a mothership on a gurney being examined by aliens, and they put me back afterwards, and I knew they put me back, so I knew consciously now, without a doubt, that they're still monitoring me, especially after the encounter at the Capitol building. What was interesting, after I encountered the green objects, I had these radiant burns over my hands and arms, and I had to go to the National Institute of Health, which is a government-sponsored medical facility in Bethesda. And a doctor, Dr. Nihal Bonet, who examined me, could not explain how I had gradient burns, which looked like I don't know if you're familiar with burning something with a magnifying glass, and how it burns in the center, and there's a gradient pattern that's associated to the sun as it heats up the area that's being focused on by the magnifying glass. It's called a gradient burn. Mm-hmm. I had gradient burns all over my fingers and hands, and that green crystals were coming out from underneath my fingernails. And that when I put green crystals in a container, which was to be used to take the crystals to the National Institute of Health for analysis, inside the container, the green crystals vanished. So they had to do I think it's called a biopsy, where they do an examination of the area and take samples out. And they couldn't ascertain how I got what appeared to be radiation burns on my hands.
Who are the aliens who are having contact with you? We've said that they're the Greys, but the Greys are the ones who get the bad rap, aren't they? They're either seen as being the bad guys, or they're seen as being the deputies for the intelligent guys.
I can't say they're the bad guys, because all of my encounters have never been hostile. In fact, everything that I've documented, none of it's hostile. It's abstract, just abstract, to say the least. But in terms of saying that, well, these things are hostile, I can't say that, because if they were hostile, I wouldn't be here talking to you about it, nor would I be explaining to you and describing the events that I experienced as a child.
When was your last encounter? Wilbur, when was your last encounter?
Last night.
You're kidding?
No, not without a doubt. Last night, and I photographed whatever
what
it was.
What happened?
Something, and lately what's been happening is formation of objects have been flying over my home, and when there are large numbers of objects, I feel dizzy. It's almost as if something is destabilizing my sense of balance. But in those periods where I feel dizzy, and I go back to the camera and look at the time code and notice that objects fly by, and I've documented these objects in the same time reference as the time that I feel sick, it says to me that there is a direct connection between whatever these objects are that passed over my home and whatever that is that's inside me that's causing me to feel their presence.
And have you collected any message from them overnight? Anything they've told you?
It's not messages, it's instructions.
And what have they said that you have to do?
Set up the camera and take pictures. It's always set up the camera and take pictures. And when I set up the camera and take pictures, look at the website. It's consistent, nightly.
Do you believe that they then are summoning you? You clearly do. Or are there occasions when you can summon them?
It goes both ways. I summon them also. And Area 51, when I noticed this object was following me and communicated with me in the desert, it told me to leave. And it freaked me out when it told me to leave. Believe me, when I got that message, I grabbed my tripod and I got out of there quick. But it was interesting. It followed me back to the hotel, which I stayed at in Rachel, Nevada, which was a Cowboys dream, and it's really nice. You got to go to that hotel if you're ever in that area.
Love to.
And I set my camera up in their courtyard, and I was not necessarily familiar with the camera. I just had the camera for about a week after I did the expedition into Area 51. But I set the camera up in the courtyard and said, okay, show yourself to me. And within 10 seconds of saying that, this object appears on video and flies through.
So you're a magnet for this. You're clearly a magnet.
I know that they're monitoring me, and like all good specimens, and like we, when we tag animals and we monitor their progress and where they go, we follow them. That's what they do to us, those that are tagged.
Recently on this show, I had the author Thomas J. Carey, Tom Carey, who is the co-author of a book called The Real Area 51. And he says that the real stuff, and there's a lot of evidence for that, is actually not happening at Area 51 and never has, really. It's all down to Wright-Patterson, and it's not Area
actually,
51 at all. What do you think?
I will disagree with that, because my physical samples taken from the perimeter of Area 51 showing objects materialize and fly through the frames. And then there was other photographers that were with me on the crew that their physical samples are a match also to what I photographed. Without a doubt, if I'm getting photographs of things in a restricted airspace, and where I was in Area 51 was restricted airspace, and my photographs show an object slithering in the sky like a snake with luminous qualities, and you know that if a human was inside that thing, that person would be smashed from side to side if it was moving in the manner in which this object was moving, like a snake, if you can imagine how a snake slithers. Mm. If you can tell me that slithering object is man-made, then I will agree with you that there's nothing extraterrestrial in Area 51, but you can't tell me that. You can't tell me how an object will suddenly appear, and my physical samples show objects suddenly appear. I've got a sample that was taken in the perimeter of Groom Lake. It shows this squiggly in the sky. It's a 2-second exposure. This object flies through the frames in 2 seconds, and it warps out into space. Look at the sample. The sample clearly indicates there was a luminous object there. It was moving so fast that in the time that the camera took the frame, which is a 2-second exposure, it imaged the object, and the object is imaged in a still manner because it stopped in front of the camera, and then it warped out into outer space in that 2-second frame period, and it was registered on film.
Quite often people who do research anywhere near Area 51 are less than politely recommended to leave by guys wearing dark uniforms and dark glasses. Did any of that happen to you?
It happened to the BBC crew that was with me, and they were indeed face down in the dirt with M16s pointed towards their heads.
Gee.
And, you know, it was interesting that while they were face down in the dirt, one of the guys who was the director of the crew, I'm not going to name him because, you know, we're not supposed to do that, but he said to me that he saw the object slithering. And here I've got the photograph as they were face down in the dirt of these objects slithering in the sky like snakes. That object followed me. It followed me to Sedona. It followed me to Shreveport. And it is now over my home nightly.
And what's your explanation for what that is?
I can't tell you what that is. I can tell you that it is not of this planet, not of this Earth.
But it sounds like some kind of energy that follows you. Doesn't necessarily inhabit you, but it goes with you. It's an energy force.
It's extraterrestrial object that is in orbit or in space cloaked that maintains surveillance on all of us that are tagged. That is.
Well, hold on. You mean the implant? You're talking about the implant?
Yes. Yes. There's obviously there are more people like myself out there. What's different though is instead of becoming psychologically or emotionally unstable by this, I've become enriched. And most people, if you look at these films where they are abducted by aliens, these guys are Looney Tunes. You know, they become reclusive. I've become more scientific about all of this. I want to go on board an alien spacecraft now.
Of course, there will be people listening to this now, and I do get emails from those people. I have a very receptive and open-minded audience, by the way, around the world. But there will be people who say this guy's crazy. And how do you counter that?
Well, I just say look at the data. And, you know, I'm actually just reflecting on that which is posted on my website, which is all my work. With the exception of those samples which are sent to me by other people, which are 100% match. But without a doubt, how would I then explain to people how I have all of these samples?
I don't know.
Look at them. They're extraordinary.
Your website's pretty compelling. You have a lot of photographs of objects that I can only describe as cigar-shaped objects, classic UFO forms there. A lot of those photographs there in great high-definition detail.
Yes.
They're white in the main. What are they?
And looking at the other samples, I've got another photographer, Wayne Miller in Idaho, who's using a D90 Nikon, and he was one of my, I would say, initiates, so to speak, because he contacted me and he explained that he was seeing these objects, and I told him he needed to take a photograph of them. And he went and bought a camera to take photographs of them. And he's taking photographs of them. And the photographs he's taking with a D90, which is a lesser technology than a D4 Nikon that I'm using, the photographs are the same, regardless.
Are you exclusively using film?
I retired film in 2008 when I transferred my film technology to a D700 Nikon. And then I went from D700 Nikon to D7000 Nikon. Then I went from D7000 Nikon to D4, which is the NASA-grade technology. And, you know, it's all in par, no matter what camera I used, even the film cameras, they all showed UFO activity. So we can't say then, oh, it's a byproduct of the camera. And back in those days when I was shooting film, they were saying it was a lab error. But the lab errors are consistent with those images imaged in space by Apollo. So we can't say they're lab errors.
Do you see the same kinds of thing on your film photographs that you see on your digital photographs that are made up of pixels?
Well, the digital stuff's much higher definition than the film samples.
But what you see, the nature of what you record,
they're exactly
the same, isn't it?
Yes.
And your website shows that very clearly.
Without a doubt.
What do you want to do next? What do you want to achieve with all of this, Wilbur?
Well, I know that in some case that this really is not going to go anywhere, because there, no matter how much physical data I put forth, disclosure, which I call this is disclosure, it's just not going to be acknowledged by the powers that be.
So why bother?
Why even bother? Well, one of the things that I looked into, since my background is film and motion pictures, and I worked with Chris Blackwell, which had Island Films, I'm looking at the development of motion picture special effects using sampled UFO colors, and I created a UFO color palette called UFO Colors, which are sampled alien colors, which apply to 3D for motion picture special effects and for 3D game development. And I want to market my color texture applications, which I created a color palette like paints. And I want to start, doing motion picture special effects using my technology, which is alien colors.
And what do you think the aliens will make of you playing back their technology, what you've discovered from them, feeding it back into the entertainment industry?
Well,
isn't it normally the other way around?
Well, the entertainment industry is feeding it into us. Well, let's feed the actual samples from this. So if, for example, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg have Industrial Light and Magic, and they do extraordinary visual effects. Now, if they utilized actual samples, sampled from a real UFO, those effects would be really off the chain. And that's what I want to approach with my color technology to these motion picture houses.
And do you think it's part of their, when I say their, I'm talking about the aliens, do you think it's part of their plan?
Yes.
That their material, their technology is fed back to us through...
Everything we have is alien. What we're talking on this little cell phone or this microphone I'm using here is back engineered from Roswell. We're talking on alien technology. I'm feeding alien technology back into the system.
And what about recent discoveries? There's a lot of hoo-ha now in the media about this stuff called graphene that they've suddenly discovered that will allow very, very lightweight, very, very clear digital displays. It's like it's lead imprinted, isn't it, on film of a kind, and that will allow smaller, lighter, better circuitry. You believe
it's
that
alien
is?
Technology. It's alien technology. All of it is.
Because it seems to have taken us an awful long time to discover this graphene that, when you look at it, you think, my God, why didn't we discover this years ago?
We're being fed all of this information.
How do you know that?
Well, look at how man has evolved since the crash of Roswell.
That could just be because of our intellect.
I doubt that very seriously. I doubt that very seriously. A lot of what we have is so advanced that when you think about it, it's not technically humanly possible.
Have the aliens ever told you that? Have they communicated that to you?
My contact with these entities are that are in communication with me is purely on a photographic level. They're basically using me and the technology that I've honed and perfected to document them, and I am documenting them.
So it's almost as if they're saying, look, we know that you can't use your naked eye to see us. We're never going to get anywhere with standard photographic technology.
And we're not using standard photographic technology.
So we've got to pick somebody like you who knows all about this and is a bit of a groundbreaker.
Yes.
Feed him the way that the message can get out there. Otherwise, it won't.
Exactly the case.
You're on a hard road, though, aren't you? This is not an easy thing you've undertaken.
Well, it's not easy. And, and I'm sitting here and I'm self-funded and at this very moment I'm working with relatively limited funds, almost like enough to get on the bus and buy a Happy Meal if I'm really doing on a good day. But even with very limited funding, I'm kicking major ass, because the data is priceless. And what I've documented on video is without a doubt not humanly possible.
We didn't talk much about Sedona. I think as we wrap this up, we need to do that because Sedona is a name that keeps coming up time and time again. What is it about that place?
Sedona is an extension to Area 51. In fact, there is a tunnel that goes from beneath the Bradshaw Ranch to Area 51. What I photographed in Area 51 materialized in Sedona. I mean, everything is connected. It's just creepy. Sedona is almost a replica on Earth to Mars. It looks exactly like Mars. And if you go out into the desert of Sedona at night, you will actually think you are on Mars. It actually feels like another planet. What I encountered out there was more of an evil presence compared to the feeling that I felt in Area 51. Area 51 was creepy. Sedona, Arizona felt evil creepy.
How so?
It was an event that I encountered while filming my big redneck vacation for Country Music Channel, where an object, I'll use Star Trek terms, dropped out of warp above my head. And as it dropped out of warp, all the dogs and coyotes in Sedona started howling. And when all the dogs and coyotes started howling, this object stopped. And as it was stopping, it was discharging smaller objects into the air like an aircraft carrier. At that point, I got completely unnerved, and I had to turn the camera on to full night vision mode and run out of the desert. When I got back to the desert, there was a hole drilled into my finger.
Wow.
And they had taken a sample of my finger, a tissue sample from my finger. It took 3 months for that hole to heal.
So these weren't your friendly aliens, the ones that have known you since you were a kid?
Not in Sedona, not in Sedona. And in fact, what was even more abstract, the last thing I did, I filmed with the BBC in April of this year. The BBC sent a crew to film me on this special, which is, I'm sure it's going to be airing there soon.
Well, if it's the BBC, it must be coming out at some time. And if they were filming in April, then I guess it's going to be a winter kind of show.
Raw production company. Raw is in England. They're called Raw. My friends Raw, Jason, and... I'm not even supposed to name these people, so you didn't hear me say Jason.
No.
But nevertheless.
That's just a pseudonym anyway.
Yes. We were in Sedona, and Jason, who is the director, which I'm not going to name his last name because you probably all will find out anyway, had me climb the side of a mountain with 80 pounds worth of gear. So when I got to the top of the mountain with all of this gear, needless to say, I was destroyed because I had never carried all that equipment up the side of a mountain as I did. I couldn't do anything at the top of the mountain. And when I set my camera up, there was an object sitting in the clouds watching us. Mm. That same object came back to the hotel hours early afterwards when they brought me back. And I went to bed in physical pain, unable to pick up my camera. That's how much pain I was in after scaling this mountain. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, something wakes me up and tells me to set up my camera. And there's no pain. The pain is gone. And I set my camera up in the back of the courtyard where my room was facing, and I pushed the button to start to take video to roll from my camera. And 2 minutes after pushing the start button, this object appears out of nowhere and materializes and flies through the frame. That's pretty creepy, to say the least. And I have it all physically documented.
Do you believe that there is a war being fought between different kinds of aliens?
I think there is a battle going on up there.
I say that because I had on this show a guy called, I think it was Richard Lenny a little while back, who uses night vision technology, a grade of night vision that officially you're not allowed to buy in the UK. I think you can have it in America. And he's seen what appears to have been dogfights up there at night.
I've got documentation of that without using night vision technology. Well, actually, I did use night vision technology to do it. But I captured a luminous object, which is the same object that I captured in Area 51, by the way, in 2010, and this luminous object was in the sky, and it had hundreds of red and blue spheres around it that were moving in tandem, and they were in pursuit of what looked like an intelligent cloud-like anomaly. It was a cloud-like mass, and this cloud-like mass I documented on several occasions, which seemed to have been observing me, but this UFO was in pursuit of this cloud-like mass. And this luminous white UFO extended a plasma beam from it. And I documented this beam of light, which this object is projecting from it, which is bent. And according to the laws of light, and we know light to a limited extent, light as we know it does not bend in unless it has plasma-type characteristics associated to it. And plasma is the only type of light energy that can bend. But this thing extended
a plasma beam. That's laser light, isn't it?
It's a form of laser. I really can't define it because I'm not that versed in plasma technology, and I would defer that to Dr. Bruce McAbee, who is my other associate. I would rather have Dr. McAbee explain his analysis of the footage that I submitted to him. But based on Dr. McAbee's analysis of what I submitted to him, the object went from 0 to 200 miles an hour in less than 10 seconds.
Do you get frustrated because you seem to be onto something? Without a doubt. But it's very hard for our human brains to decipher, interpret what it is you're onto.
Well, you have to consider most of us are clueless. And in a clueless disposition, essentially. And I'll get people who dispute my materials, and they're disputing it based on what kind of physical data. They must know something that I don't know for them to dispute something, but they don't. And essentially what happens is when fear sets in, a person will speak out of their ass, and normally they do. They'll say anything and everything to try to put logical sense to that which is unknown. And fear is a common factor in trying to persuade people into believing that these objects are real, but because they are in fear, they're not going to believe that at all. The fear stops them, and we're essentially held captive by our fears, and fear is a disease.
I think that's a good point to park this. I think we do have to talk again, though, Wilbur. I hope you stay safe and I hope you stay well. What is your next big hurdle? What's the next thing you're taking on?
Well, I'm trying to get funding for my website.
All right. Well, let's name the website then. Let's tell people where it is.
They can go to my website, and there's a donation button at ufodc.com, and they can send me anything they'd like to send me. I use all of my funds. One of the things I want to do, and I've got a lecture I'm doing in Edinburgh, Scotland, I believe, next year. Really? I'm going to scan Loch Ness. I don't believe that what they claim Loch Ness to be as swamp gas. I don't believe that at all.
What, do you believe that alien craft maybe are going in and out of Loch Ness? I think that's been said before, but is that what you think?
I believe it's a plesiosaurus that's there, and keep in mind, Loch Ness is a pool of water that's been separated from a larger mass of water. So if anything was trapped in there, it's trapped there. And it is a very strong possibility that there is a dinosaur that's still alive in Loch Ness.
Wow. You're going to be busy. Your website, www.ufo, and the UFO is uppercase, and the DC bit is lowercase, isn't it, .com?
Yeah, either way, it goes to the same place. UFODC, Google UFODC, all goes to the same place.
Hey,
UFODC.com.
UFODC.com, okay. Do you ever get back to Sheringham in Norfolk, where you grew up?
I plan on doing that. And I know there's a lot of alien activity there, and I'm just dying to talk to the people and to see what they've experienced. Because England, by far, and I know there's action going on there that the Queen is not talking about, that, you know, that aliens are visiting the UK. They've been visiting the UK since 1962. I can vouch for that because that's when I encountered them there. And I definitely want to go back to England, not for the fact that it's a beautiful country, but by the fact that it is indeed one of the places that aliens have conquested, so to speak.
And we have to say that Sheringham in Norfolk is not an awful long way away from another place that's very famous, Rendlesham Forest.
Exactly.
And that is a whole other conversation. Hey, Wilbur, I know you're going to be going to bed soon. It's we're recording this at about 10 o'clock in the morning, UK right now, which is, what is that? I'm trying to do the math. 5 a.m. for you. It's almost bedtime for you, isn't it?
No, I don't go to bed until the sun rises like a vampire.
Let's talk again, Wilbur. Thank you very much.
Howard, thank you for having me, sir.
Pretty thought-provoking stuff, eh? Wilbur Allen, you let me know what you think about that, won't you, at www.theunexplained.tv. There you can send me your feedback and thoughts about the show or make a donation to it. Our website, designed by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, www.theunexplained.tv. And on my website, I'll stick a link to Wilbur Allen and his work, and you can see what you think of it. More great guests coming soon. Thank you for your suggestions. Please keep those coming. I am very grateful for all of the feedback that you give me. Please keep that coming too. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained, and I will return with another edition very soon. Take care.